because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
I also want to thank...
I did not have relations with that woman.
From somewhere deep in the heartland of the resistance.
We have a very special guest. We have Dr. Tawfiq Hamid with us. He just has a great insight and an insider's view to something that most of us never have an opportunity to have any knowledge of. So I want to welcome Dr. Hamid to the show and just tell him thank you for coming.
It's a pleasure to be with you tonight.
Dr. Hamid, you know, it's like I said, this show is one of the shows I do personally just for my own selfish pleasure, because through this show I get to meet some of the most interesting people and have the opportunity to talk with them and share with them and to learn from them. And so that's what I'd love to do tonight. You have a wealth of knowledge and insight that I will never have, although my wife and I and my family, we spent 5 years in an Islamic country. You still grew up with it and are very familiar with many things that we have no knowledge of. So thank you for sharing with us tonight ahead of time, and I want to get right into what we're going to do tonight.
Absolutely.
If you could, for a few moments, just tell us a little bit. Now, I glossed over some of your history here, but tell us a little bit about how you were involved with radical Islamic groups and then why you left.
Actually, I was born for a very secular family, and around the age of 15, I started to think about God and creation. My family was not religious at all, and when I started to think, it was just individual desire to know who created me, and I had a passion for God. I wanted to do something for Him, and this passion, when I went to the medical school, I was invited by some people of the radical group Jama'a Islamiyah, and I thought that I'm doing something good for God. That's what was my thinking back then.
Okay.
And I joined the group and I became radicalized, and it was all theoretical teaching of hatred and desire to do violence. I desired to go to Afghanistan, do jihad. I thought about doing certain forms of crimes, but when it comes to the moment when I have been when I was asked to do a real crime with them, to share with them in a real act, I had awakening of my conscience, and since then I decided to retreat, and I started to think again in my beliefs, my thinking, and I gradually left them, and they started a form of reformation and new ways of thinking within Islam.
Let me play a clip for you. This is George Bush, former President George Bush, talking about the war with Islam.
Yeah.
If I can get it to play here.
These acts of violence against innocents violate the fundamental tenets of the Islamic faith. And it's important for my fellow Americans to understand that. The enemy of America is not our many Muslim friends. It is not our many Arab friends. Americans understand we fight not a religion. Ours is not a campaign against the Muslim faith. Our war is against evil, not against Islam. There are thousands of Muslims who proudly call themselves Americans.
Now, Dr. Hamid, I'll be honest with you. I spend an enormous amount of time on the internet researching for this show and pulling together material. And over the course of the last 10 years or so, I run into hundreds, maybe thousands of people who would disagree with this clip. They feel that we are actually at war with Islam itself. Living in an Islamic country, I lived in Turkey, like I said, for 5 years, where the Turkish people that I lived with were far from radicalized. How would you respond to those people who want to make this a war on religion? Is that actually true, or try to help us understand it from your viewpoint?
Look, I think both sides have some points that I consider correct. I cannot say on one hand, there are Muslims who are relatively cultured Muslims, who are not very radical, but you cannot judge the ideology itself by some people who are not radical, or because these people may not be actually implementing or applying their ideology. So I see some people judge Islam by the behavior of some individuals, and this is not what really the critiques of Islam are trying to do. The critiques are going to the ideology itself.
Sure.
And when it comes to the ideology, we cannot deny certain facts that according to Sharia law, until this moment that I'm speaking to you, all Islamic jurisprudence apply and accept certain value, which is that Muslims, once they achieved power, they should declare war, or they must declare war on non-Muslims, offering them one of three options: either to convert to Islam or to pay humiliating tax called jizya, or you will be killed. And
right.
This principle is still what is being taught in major Islamic institutions all over the world. It was not a challenge, and you don't hear many scholars rejecting it. What happened, Rick, was simply that in the latest few decades, the radical groups, and I witnessed this myself,
okay,
the jihadists took this principle of declaring war on the non-Muslims from a nation level or a national level to individual level. So in the past, a Muslim was not supposed to attack an individual Christian or Jew. It was supposed that the Muslim nation declares war against the Roman Empire, for example. What happened? They changed it based on certain Quranic verse and certain hadith to say no, jihad and war should be a personal responsibility. And since then, they took the responsibility of declaring war or doing violent acts at individual or personal level, and that is the root cause of what we see today from terrorism and radicalism and violence. So I cannot say that there is no problem in the ideology. There is a problem in the teaching, and it's unchallenged. And the passive attitude of the Muslim world, we have seen, for example, demonstrations against the cartoons of Prophet Muhammad, but we haven't
right.
seen similar demonstrations against Bin Laden. This can tell a story by itself. So we cannot say, this is what I call passive terrorists. So we cannot really say there is no problem in the ideology, and we cannot say people who remain passive are okay completely. There is something really you cannot consider those who have fear from Islam or Islam, what some people call Islamophobia. I can say it's fully justifiable, because there is element here in the ideology and element in the passive attitude of people. But at the pragmatic, with the pragmatic way of thinking, you have to think not in just like the word fighting religion may be what makes it complicated, because practically you cannot really remove a religion completely from earth. So, but you, at the end, there is a fight against an ideology. You can call it interpretation of this religion, historical facts supporting it. The scholars who are passive and do not really confront these radical teachings are to be blamed. But I cannot really blame people who have this negative attitude about Islam, because
yeah.
of the
Now, when we look at the world population, most Americans have no idea how big the population of Islam is. Is it the second largest world religion?
It's 1.5 billion. They are the second, but when you consider the fact of the level of dedication to their belief, you are talking about more than a billion dedicated. So it's in number they are second, but I think when it comes to the very dedicated people to their religion, they might be first.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we lived in Turkey, I often noticed that, and I'll use this phrase, I'll see if I can explain it. Most Turks were were Islamic, like most Americans were Christian, twice a year. They would celebrate Islamic holidays,
yeah.
but then outside of the holidays, they were not as adherent to the religion as now. There were some who were, but by and large, most were busy just working their job, raising their families, and it did not totally saturate into their lifestyle like you would see in some of these other countries.
Yeah.
Here in America, we find a lot of people who claim to be Christian, but in reality, they participate in Christian services, you know, Christmas and Easter, and maybe, you know, a funeral, things like that.
Yeah.
Is that similar across all of Islam, or isn't that just for Turkey?
Actually, Turkey is a special case, because you remember Kemal Atatürk, who was the one who started the new modern Turkey.
Yes.
He was an atheist, and he really suppressed Islam. So the outcome that you see today in Turkey is not the normal outcome of Islam. It is the outcome of a suppressed form of Islam, mixed with secularism. In fact, the current Muslim prime minister was in Egypt recently, the one of Turkey, I mean. He
yes.
visited Egypt, and he supported secularism, and he said the country must not have a religion. I have a religion, but the country must be secular. So you are talking here about very special case. And also remember, they don't know Arabic very well. So when it comes out, when we go outside Turkey, I can see the Muslim world was to a great extent like Turkey, as you described it a few decades ago.
Okay.
Like if you see like the generation of my father and my mother, Islam was just very superficial, just celebration in Ramadan. Most people didn't even pray the five prayers. Hijab was unknown. What happened was very simple process. Saudi Arabia became wealthy.
Right.
And when they became wealthy because of oil, many people in the countries around it, the Muslim countries, said, look how Allah blessed the Saudis, or God blessed them with oil and petrol, because they implemented this form of Islam, which, as you know, extremely suppressive for the other. Christian Jews couldn't survive. Women extremely suppressed. Complete cover of women. No music. No art. The other parts of the Muslim world were relatively less radical, or were relatively moderate. So what happened, the Saudi model was taken, was followed by the other countries, because they saw this is a source of blessing, to be wealthy, to have oil, to have all this blessing is coming from implementing Sharia law. When they started to implement Sharia law, you start to see the hijab, people starting to pray. So what we have today in the Muslim world, the Muslim world is huge, but I can say the tendency toward Islamization is more powerful than in Turkey. And the Arab world has another special problem, because they know the language very well, so they actually can argue, and the violent people can use verses to argue for their beliefs. So I see Turkey is in a much better situation than the rest of the Muslim world. I can see a huge difference here, and Turkey is much more modern, closer to Europe. It has some problem, yes, but yeah, we can't compare. Yeah.
Now, the largest Islamic country in the world, I believe, is Indonesia. Is that correct?
Yeah, Indonesia in number, but when it comes to influence in Islam, they are, in my view, the weakest.
Right, okay, that's what I wanted to know.
They don't have any influence. If you studied Islamic theology, you will never find a single contribution, not even two. I'm talking about a single contribution from any Indonesian scholar. They are not considered as real Muslims by the Arab Muslims. They are considered people, yes, who follow the Islam, but they look to them as just second or third class Muslims. This is I'm not saying that's correct, good or correct, but I'm describing a fact that you don't see one single contribution from Indonesia. When Indonesians want to learn Islam, they go to Al-Azhar in Egypt. They go to Saudi Arabia. The other way around never and will never happen, because Islam is dependent on Arabic language, the language of the Quran.
Right.
And if
right.
it's not your native language, they can't really consider you someone who can really understand the religion correctly.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're speaking with Dr. Hamid, and this is a unique opportunity for you. If you'd like to call and talk and ask a question, we'd ask you to do so with respect and politeness, but you can call us here at 917-889-8870. The phone lines are open for questions, and we also would take questions in the chat room. Doctor, we have people in the chat room, but amazingly so, it's very, very quiet in the chat room. Normally, there are several conversations going on. Very often, they're off topic for whatever we're talking about, and periodically, they'll say something or ask a question through the chat room. But tonight, the chat room is virtually silent. I think they're paying very close attention to what you had to say, and I appreciate them doing so. But, ladies and gentlemen, once again, if you'd like to call, the number 917-889-8870. Dr. Being from Egypt, you're, I'm sure, very familiar, and you're keeping very close tabs on the Arab Spring movement that's taking place. We, as Americans, we get what is going on through our television and through maybe some internet access and things like that. I don't think we're getting a full picture, because initially we were told that this was a spring well of democracy, that this was democracy flowering up. Educate us. Tell us what's really going on.
What's really going on is a form of democracy, but a form of democracy that will bring theocracy at the end. So it's democracy should be seen, or must be seen, as a process that ultimately should bring freedom and liberty. But what happened, we focused on the process, and the West here focused on democracy and demanded democracy, and they didn't know that if you have democracy in Taliban, for example, they will choose Bin Laden. So what is more important than democracy was the outcome of democracy. They missed this part, and they pushed for democratic changes in this part of the world without fully understanding the complexity on ground. The situation was very simple. Islamism was proliferating for the last 40 years. Most people were becoming Islamized. The majority of women wearing the hijab, 20%, for example, in Egypt, wear the niqab, which is complete face cover. You see the effect of Islamization on TV, in the media, everywhere. You see that country is becoming more Islamized, the more Saudi style of Islam, burning of churches was happening. So what happened when they started to have elections? The outcome was simple. Majority of people want Islamism. Majority wants Sharia. So the outcome at the end is what we see today is the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafi group, which is a very, very extremely regressive group, more than even the Muslim Brotherhood, are winning, and it's creating severe friction within the society that I'm really worried that it can end into a form of some sort of civil wars and major troubles. Because once Islamists rule Egypt, they will kill tourism industry, because they will not allow freedom of women to wear swimming togs. They will not allow alcohol, so tourism will just collapse. And this is fundamental source for money for the Egyptian people. Number two, they will start to have frictions with Israel, because they support Hamas, and deeply none of them really believe in the peace treaty with Israel. So they will start to have frictions with Israel that can end in wars, that can end in troubles from the Suez Canal area, which can interrupt more the flow of money coming to the country. Number three, they will have another friction with the Coptic Christians living in the country, suppressing them. And as you know, the Nile River has its roots in Ethiopia and Uganda. Both are Christian nations. So right. When they start to discriminate against Christians, this can create another form of friction. So the three of them ultimately can end into a real disaster. This is what is happening, that the pushing for democracy was not wise. I wrote op-eds clearly before what is called the Arab Spring, saying that democracy will not end radical Islam. And this was my view, and my view was that if you want to implement democracy in these parts of the world, number one, you need to work with the current leaders to fight radicalism and radical views in the society. Number two, you need education to accept the other and have love toward your neighbor. Number three, you go for ballot democracy. If you don't go through these stages in this sequence of sequence, you lose the game. And this is what's happening today.
Now, currently, I'm seeing reports scattered across some news agencies, but mostly on the internet and through C-SPAN, where the Copt Christians are being persecuted very severely. Is this basically from Muslim Brotherhood and this other agency you spoke about?
Not from the Muslim Brotherhood as an organization, and it's happening. I can say the Salafi groups are more responsible at individual level, but I can say both of them are contributing factors to the creation of hatred to the other. For example, when the Muslim Brotherhood say that we will not accept a Christian to become a president for Egypt, then you are starting to see them as an inferior to you. It's a form of justification for another guy who will come to say, I will not accept a church to be built on my Muslim land. And a third guy who will come and say, we have to burn this church. So I cannot say they are completely innocent of what of what's happening. They didn't probably order people to go and burn churches. I have to be honest here. They will not do this. But they create the atmosphere that ultimately lead to this violence against the Christians.
You mentioned something earlier that you felt that they would, if they come into power, would severely hamper or stop most tourism.
Yeah.
That got me to thinking, do you believe that the Muslim Brotherhood and these other more radical organizations would attack cultural icons like the Taliban did in Afghanistan when they destroyed the Buddhist statues?
Some of them are talking about this issue individually. Salafi, from the Salafi group, not the Muslim Brotherhood,
right.
The Salafi groups, they started to cover the statues because they consider them idols. Some wants to destroy them. It's a vicious cycle. Once there is hatred, once there is lack of love and lack of tolerance toward the other and inability to accept the other, believe me, it can start mild, but it will go more and more and more, and it can reach a very, very bad levels. So I'm not saying at this stage the Muslim Brotherhood is promoting destruction of the ancient Pharaoh culture. They don't advocate this at the moment, and I don't think they will. But again, if you don't stand powerfully against evil, then you facilitate it. I'm blaming them for simple thing. When they saw people speaking in this way, saying we should destroy these ancient monuments of the ancient Egyptians, they should have responded to this in a very aggressive and strong manner. And I haven't seen them doing a really strong reaction against this statement.
Ladies and gentlemen, when we come back from break, we're going to be talking about radical Islam and its recruiting in the United States. I would encourage you to get your questions ready over the break time and call us when we come back, 917-889-8870. We have Dr. Hamid with us for about another hour, and this is one very unique opportunity for us, so I don't want you to miss it. Please stay with us as we come back from the break. We'll get into more interesting discussion.
Digital broadcast, Salisbury, North Carolina.
Hi, this is Primo Mondoni of Red State Talk Radio. I'm pleased to announce the first annual Red State Talk Radio Talk Show of the Year Award. This award will be determined by you, the listeners. Simply visit our website at redstatetalkradio.com and cast your vote in our online poll for your favorite program. You have until December 31st to let your voice be heard. The winner will be announced on New Year's Day.
Hi, I'm Rick Johnson from Paul Revere Radio. I want to encourage you to visit redstatetalkradio.com. Scroll down the right side of the page where the voting is taking place and vote for Paul Revere Radio. While you're there, make sure you check out all the other great program you'll find on redstatetalkradio.com. Remember, one if by land, two if by sea, three if by government. Paul Revere Radio.
Radio. Ghost Fighter. Fighter Radio. Ghost Fighter Radio. Ghost Fighter
Radio. Where the greatest shows on the net. Andrea Shea King. Jimmy Z. Captain's America. Darren Marlar. Getting After Lefty. The Conservative Brigade.
And many more. Many more. Many more.
Ghost Fighter Radio. Go to theghostfighters.net, where we are fighting the forces of tyranny. One radio show at a time. Ghost Fighter Radio. Ghost Fighter Radio. Ghost Fighter Radio. Ghost Fighter Radio.
Hi, this is the Candy Conservative with today's minute on cleaning up our own yard first. Words and images are often more about deception than description. Actions speak best to the sincere mission of everyone, including politicians. Republicans continue to talk and pretend conservative, but actions give them away. The absurdities of the supercommittee and automatic budget cuts being one recent example. Almost everyone in Congress went with this confidence game. It's folly to drop a marble off a building and plan on it going up. If Republican leaders are ever to operate from principle, that transition will have to begin at the local level. County party organizations have the power to turn the lights on the voting records of candidates and thus strengthen a match between walk and talk. We're responsible for our own children. Complaining about donkey offspring while we ignore Republican missteps assures we'll never have the party of promise and principle America so desperately needs. I'm Dr. Carl Mumpower, and you just spent a minute with a grass-mowing candid conservative.
The path to restoring our republic was laid down by our founding fathers. The principles of freedom, liberty, personal responsibility, and limited government are conservative ideals we will never abandon.
America is listening.
Grassroots, common sense, conservative talk radio. It's on the internet. Tune in now. Red State Talk Radio, featuring some of the most popular internet talk show hosts in America today. Are you listening? RedStateTalkRadio.com.
If you were able to choose the planet you lived on, which one would it be? Well, I would definitely choose Earth because it's so well suited for life. Whether you're considering the Earth's distance from the Sun or its gravity, axial tilt or magnetic field, one conclusion is inescapable. Earth is finely tuned for life. Many see this as evidence for a designer, but others don't. If Earth wasn't finely tuned, they say, we wouldn't even exist, so it doesn't indicate a designer. But is that a satisfactory answer? Imagine you were dragged before a trained firing squad, and they all fired and all missed. If I asked you why you're not dead and you answered, well, if I did die, I wouldn't be here to tell you, you think I'd be satisfied with that explanation? In the same way, atheists can't give a satisfactory answer for Earth being so finely tuned for life.
To find out more from Creation Ministries International, visit our website, creation.com.
Listening to WPRR Digital Broadcast, Salisbury, North Carolina.
And we are back with Dr. Hamid. Dr. Hamid, you've been on C-SPAN, Fox News, and other shows.
Yeah.
What made you accept a challenge to come on a little bitty internet radio program like this?
Actually, I always feel that I have a responsibility to tell the truth, or what I feel or I believe it is the truth. So wherever there is an opportunity to say it, even for one single individual, I feel happy to do it. So I never think really what type of news, what type of media, if it is internet or, because I say what I believe in my heart, and it could be big media, small media, irrespective how many people will listen to it. I feel it's my responsibility to deliver this message in every chance I could.
Well, you got
how
me.
I see it.
You got me smiling because you got us pegged. We're small media. We'll probably have somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 listeners through the night tonight. But over the course of the next 3 or 4 months, this show will be picked up and rebroadcast all over Facebook and on other websites. And we'll pick up several thousand people over the course of time. So the message travels. As long, and I'm with you. As long as truth's being spoken, we're a good place for it. So thank you once again for participating with us. Now, when we left, I said that we wanted to talk about radical Islam recruiting here in the United States. And this has been something that's been slowly building over the last decade or so. But where I'm seeing a lot of information and reading a lot is about radical Islam recruiting in our prison systems. Are you seeing that? Is that the primary place that this recruiting is taking place, or has it now spread to a lot of other places?
I believe it's spread to different places, because in the prison there is chance that individual preaching and individual recruitment can occur. This is one possibility. But we should always remember that the internet is there and information is available. We have seen cases here in the United States in home ground terrorists like Nadal Hassan, who was radicalized by message coming from Yemen. So just imagine a guy who was in California and Virginia actually at some stage, an American guy called Al-Awlaqi, born in here in America, traveled to Yemen and starting spreading his messages via the internet from Yemen to be picked up here in Florida by Nadal Hassan, who committed his crime. And it happened also for Shahzad in New York, the one who prepared the car to explode in Manhattan.
Right.
So we talk about different types of radicalism. It can happen at individual level, reading and dedicated. It's not criminal mind. This is what I would like to clarify here. Many of these people do not have the traditional criminal mind. They are people who are dedicated to serve their religion, and this is how they consider it. The ultimate thing to do is to fight for the cause of Allah, to die for Him as a martyr. So they have it's not traditional criminal mind, and radicalism and recruitment can actually occur at different levels, from individual people speaking to through mosques. I'm not saying that every mosque and every individual is doing it, but I'm talking about the vehicles. You talk about the methods. The prison is one of them. The mosques happened in Virginia. I live here in North Virginia. It's very close to us, the mosque where people were get young Americans got radicalized, the Pakistani ones who went to Pakistan and now they are in prison. You have recruitment via the internet. So we cannot limit it to the prison only. It's a mix of different things.
Now, the internet is a great subject that's been coming up lately, especially now that Congress is talking about formulating different types of restrictions. Would you feel that is something that should be done, or should the internet just be monitored and watched? How would you approach that if you were asked to testify to these congressional groups? How would you testify to that?
I believe that having some form of restrictions can be useful, especially if they are well designed to prevent the spread of incitement for violence. If you criticize an ideology, you should be allowed, you must be allowed to do this, because this is your freedom to criticize. But I don't think it is the right of any individual to go and say we should, for example, kill the Jews, or we should kill Christians, we should have a war against America, which incites both hatred and violent acts at the end. We cannot always wait for the last moment until the violent act materialized. What we need to do is to attack the process at an earlier stage, which I called in one of my op-eds, let us start fighting terrorism in Brainistan, from the brain, the impulse of hatred. Yeah, in the brain.
Yeah, I like that.
We don't have to wait for the guy to get the bomb in his hand and start throwing it on us. So I think having some form of restrictions, if it is wisely done and designed, you can really limit the spread of hate message and prevent others from pursuing this path.
Now, as a person who uses the internet a lot, and I have a filter system on my computer to keep certain things out of my computer system, but you know, part of me, the person who's the constitutional, looks at that and says, you know, when you start doing that, you're violating constitutional principles. On the other hand, I think you make a very good point. It is a massive recruiting tool. And, you know, like you said, a person can sit in a foreign country, preach any type of hate that they wish to preach, push a button, and it's instantaneously spread all across the entire world.
Yes.
And so, but do you think that they really could, without limiting everyone's freedom, be able to filter the system in such a way that they could keep this? I mean, you know, geeks and techies. As soon as you put a filter system out there, they're going to find a way to get around it.
I really don't know if this will be via filter system or via criminalizing spreading this information, because there are different ways to do it. You can just say whoever will spread this information to incite violence against others is a criminal and will be punished. This is another way to do it without having to go through filters.
That's a good point.
What I want to clarify here is that we need probably to think with our forefathers here in America who decided freedom of speech, freedom of expression. We need to understand that their intention was to the safety of the society and to build a good society where people are not suppressed. But I cannot imagine that they intended that people promote violence against others and they should allow this to happen. I believe
if
our fathers were alive today, they would have just think with the same wisdom that made them created the first rule by having some amendment to it. And we need to really distinguish between two important thoughts here. Some thoughts are just perceptive thoughts, like someone believing that God has long nose and two long ears. It's up to him, okay? I don't believe in this, okay? I don't like it, but it's up to him. And any hurt to my feeling is just psychological, okay? But there is a difference between this and someone who is inciting others to cause physical harm to others, telling, you can go and stone a woman to death, or like in Islamic Sharia, or you have to go and kill apostates, or you have to declare war against Christians. This is a violent act that can cause not psychological damage, physical damage to others. I think we need to distinguish between these two types of thoughts, the perceptive thoughts and thoughts that can cause psychological harm on one hand, and the thoughts and the promotion of values that can end in violence and physical harm to others. You can't go tell someone, if your daughter had a boyfriend, you have to kill her, and he can kill her at the end. This is an act of violence. It is a crime. It's incitement for a crime. Like when you go in a car and you get the alcohol level in smell, you don't have to wait for the accident. The guy didn't do an accident, yet you punish him. Because he already got a level of alcohol that can lead to an accident. The same here, when you promote violence or hatred that can cause physical violence toward the others, I believe any sane system must interrupt this at an early stage, and we should not let it just go as many people think it should be.
Yeah, I'm just sitting here nodding my head, agreeing with you 100%. And ladies and gentlemen, I want to turn this a little bit and say that goes both directions. I mean, we're thinking, personally, he's talking about radical Islam that's talking about attacking Christians or Jews. I want to turn it and say it's just as bad going the other direction. Just after 9/11, I was working for a small company, and every morning I stopped into a small convenience store that was run by two Pakistani men. Immediately after 9/11, their life became a living heck. It was very difficult for them, and they actually ended up closing business and moving to another location because of the number of people who instantly said, you're from Pakistan, you must be Muslim, you must be part of this process or this problem. And that's just as bad. And a lot of it's just straight out of ignorance and fear. And that's one of the reasons I greatly appreciate having you here, is to try to eliminate some of the ignorance and allow people through a different perspective.
Actually, thank you for mentioning this, because I fully agree completely that it should be from both sides. The concept of generalization is really a very bad concept, an evil concept. When you do something wrong to me, I punish everyone who belongs to your culture or your... This is fundamentally evil, because you punish innocent people at the end. And I think looking to the Muslim society, I classified them in a, like, if you imagine bull's eye circles, five circles, one followed by the other, you have what they can call culture Muslims, who are people whose name is Muhammad or Fatima. They don't know anything about the religion more than this. They may celebrate in some celebration, but they are not really religious. Then you have ritual Muslims who just focus on the rituals, fasting, doing the prayers, and they stop here. They don't even believe in Sharia laws. They're just individuals who wanted to have some religious like values at the level of rituals, not more than this. Then you have theological Muslims who studied Sharia, who want to implement the Sharia and force women on the hijab, stop alcohol by force, stop pork, all of this ideologies coming out of Sharia. You have the theological level, and this level is dangerous because the more they increase in the society, they can create friction between within civilizations and can start civil problems like in Europe, which might happen in the future.
Yeah.
Then you have radical Muslims who come by force and force you on doing things, and you have the jihadists who explode themselves and others and kill innocents.
Right.
So you have a shade here. It's not something. I give a simple example. If you don't mind, I will just illustrate it to you, to the audience, because it can clarify the difference in the society, in the Islamic society. Imagine if we have a party together tonight and we invited people. Someone was called Muhammad. If Muhammad is a Muslim, he enjoyed the party with us, or Fatima, and they drank with us, they danced, and they really didn't show any hatred or any rejection. They are just cultural Muslims. His name is just Muhammad. If Muhammad came and said to you, excuse me, I'll just go to pray and come to enjoy the night with you, and he went to his prayer for at his time and came back in few minutes, that is a ritual Muslim. If Muhammad came and said, no, I'm so sorry, I don't like you drinking alcohol or dancing in front of me, that's un-Islamic and I will leave, and he left in with anger, this is the theological Muslim. If Muhammad came and took the wine bottle and broke it, this is a radical Muslim. If Muhammad exploded the place, then you will recognize that is the jihadist. So you have different shades, and it's fundamental to be able to distinguish, so that we can test actually societies, and I'm talking here at a big level, intelligence and military, and also individually you can categorize a person. Well, if he is just, his name is just Muhammad, you can't hate someone because his name was Muhammad. If he's a good person, why should you hate him?
That is probably the best laid out example I have ever heard.
Thank you so much.
This entire hour and a half, I'm going to boil it down to that 1 minute, and I'll cut that 1 minute out and use it. That was absolutely the best example that makes perfect sense. And you can apply that in any direction. I mean, you can see that in 100 different ways. So thank you very much for that. All right, ladies and gentlemen, you have your opportunity. The number here, 917-889-8870. And the chat room's talking a little bit, but once again, they're all just saying that they're enjoying listening to you and they're learning a great deal from what you have to say. I want to shift and ask you some questions here. You've probably heard about the kerfuffle that's kicked up over this TV show called All American Muslim. And there's a group in Florida that's asked for people to boycott the different advertisers. And I guess the most prominent advertiser that is pulled out is Lowe's hardware, and you know, they do lumber and stuff like that.
Yeah.
What do you think the purpose of this show, All American Muslim, is all about? Why do you think they decided to? I mean, you got to admit, right now, you know, it's a pretty touchy subject. Why do you think they did this?
I think, in my view, they did this as a protective mechanism, because many Muslims who are not actually pro Bin Laden, or they fit in the class of culture to rituals to some extent, many of them are afraid of what they consider Islamophobia. They are afraid of reaction against them. So they thought about this idea of trying to improve their image in the society. I think this, if you dig deeply, this will be the main thing. But the real problem is coming from, or stems from, the fact that the Muslim societies until today did not really show clear stand against violence committed in the name of their religion. And that is a huge problem. Like you, as I mentioned earlier, the concept of passive terrorism or passive approval of Sharia with stoning. Just a couple of days ago, some witchcraft or sorcerer in Saudi Arabia was beheaded,
yes.
For example. Beheaded.
Right.
But you don't see any anger from the Muslim society. You don't see them in their media criticizing this powerfully. Or criticizing the concept of honor killing strongly, so you cannot say the society are terrorists, but at the same time they accept to some extent or they have passive attitude toward certain values that endanger the Westerners. So the Westerners have the full right also to feel afraid and to have phobia from this system. In fact, the word Islamophobia is misleading, because the word phobia in psychology, if you define it, it's an irrational belief of something. So it has to be irrational. But when you come to fear from Islamism, it is very rational. When you see the number of terror acts conducted by the Islamists, when you see the numbers of stoning and beheadings and the passive attitude of the Muslim world with these things, so you have actually triangle here. You have the Westerners who are afraid, and their fear is based on the reality. It's not their base. Their fear is not based on nothing. They don't have Buddhophobia. They don't have Hinduphobia. It's Islamophobia. Muslims should ask themselves why there is no Hinduphobia or Buddhophobia. Because Buddhists are not the ones who commit every other day a terror act and behead humans in the streets and beat women and allow polygamy and allow pedophilia in Sharia, in their Sharia or in their laws. So we have to ask, first of all, why the phobia is specific to the Muslims. It's not white, not against the Buddhists or Hindus. There is something here that must be addressed. And I think the more the Muslim societies become honest enough to admit that there is a problem, but there are ways to reinterpret, for example, the teaching or have form of reformation to understand it differently, I feel they will have more respect in the West and people will start to trust them. But as long as the Muslim world and the Muslim organization are trying to deny the mere existence of the problem, you can't stop the fear, and you can't stop the Islamophobia then.
Very, very good point. We're up against our second break, and when we come back, I want to ask the doctor about his viewpoint on Occupy Wall Street, and is there a tie to some of the things that we're talking about tonight? And I'm also going to tell you who purchased all the advertising time that was lost on All American Muslim when Lowe's pulled out. So when we come back from this break, you'll find out that and more. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WPRR Digital Broadcast, Salisbury, North Carolina.
This is Primo Mondoni of Red State Talk Radio. I'm pleased to announce the first annual Red State Talk Radio Talk Show of the Year Award. This award will be determined by you, the listeners. Simply visit our website at redstatetalkradio.com and cast your vote in our online poll for your favorite program. You have until December 31st to let your voice be heard. The winner will be announced on New Year's Day.
I'm Rick Johnson from Paul Revere Radio. I want to encourage you to visit redstatetalkradio.com. Scroll down the right side of the page where the voting is taking place and vote for Paul Revere Radio. While you're there, make sure you check out all the other great programming you'll find on redstatetalkradio.com. Remember, one if by land, two if by sea, three if by government. Paul Revere Radio.
From FSN, I'm Kate Moody with the latest world news. The United States has officially declared the Iraq war over after nearly 9 years of combat. Daniel Wrenches reports from Washington.
Marking the official end of the war in Baghdad with a ceremony called the Casing of the Flag, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta says it has all been worth it.
That your sacrifice has helped the Iraqi people begin a new chapter in history, free from tyranny and full of hope for prosperity and peace.
Polls suggest the American public is overwhelmingly in favor of the withdrawal, but Republican Senator John McCain, speaking on NBC's Today Show, has concerns that no residual force will remain.
And I think it's a great risk, and I think it was unnecessary. We always envisioned some residual force.
U.S. officials have been unable to agree on a continued presence because the Iraqi government has refused to provide troops with legal immunity. But defense officials are hoping to negotiate on the issue next year. Daniel Wrenches, Washington.
Syrian authorities ordered troops to use all means necessary to quash anti-government protests, according to a new report by the Human Rights Watch group. The organization interviewed more than 60 defectors from the Syrian military and intelligence agencies who said they were given instructions to arrest, torture, or shoot demonstrators. The United Nations believes that at least 5,000 people have been killed since the uprising began in March. Anna Niestat, a researcher with Human Rights Watch, says Syrian soldiers were authorized to use lethal force.
Defectors from all over Syria told us that they received both standing and direct orders from their commanders to kill, detain, and beat people.
This is FSN.
Tune into Ghost Fighter Radio. Ghost Fighter Radio. Ghost Fighter Radio. Ghost Fighter Radio.
For the greatest shows on the net. Andrea Shea King, Jimmy Z, Captain America, Darren Marlar, Getting After Lefty, The Conservative Brigade,
and many more.
Ghost Fighter Radio. Go to theghostfighters.net, where we are fighting the forces of tyranny. One radio show at a time. Ghost Fighter Radio. Ghost Fighter Radio. Ghost Fighter Radio. Ghost Fighter Radio.
Homeowners, did you know a burglar could break into your home and get away in just 5 minutes? A locked door may not be enough to keep a thief out of your home. Think about what you can lose, and then think about this. Now you can get a free security system monitored by ADT, the leader in home security. Pick up your phone now and get free hardware, free medical and fire alert, and free activation. It's an $850 value. Just call Protect Your Home, your authorized ADT dealer, at 1-800-841-0359. You'll get 24-hour protection, and there's no cost for parts or activation. So call now about a free security system monitored by ADT. Call 1-800-841-0359. $99 installation charge. 36-month monitoring agreement at $35.99 a month. Call for terms and conditions to this offer and protect your home license numbers. Call now. 1-800-841-0359. That's 1-800-841-0359.
Tired of the same old blah, blah, blah of talk radio? Then tune in to Red State Town Hall, where we're always in a rockin' red state of mind. Join your hosts, Primo Mondoni and Ken Brown, for spirited discussion and debate on all things conservative every Wednesday and Saturday evening.
10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific.
Here on blogtalkradio.com. You can live chat with other right-wing extremists and vent your frustrations by calling in to talk to us. See you at the town hall.
My name is Nicole Johnson, and you're listening to my granddad upon Revere Radio.
Okay, we're back for the last 30 minutes of the show, and just before I left, I asked you if you knew who had purchased the advertising time that was lost when Lowe's and some other agencies pulled out of the show All American Muslim. And I asked in the chat room, nobody seemed to know, and so I'll tell you, because I'm just that kind of guy. Russell Simmons and Mia Farrow have decided they're going to put their money where their mouth is, and they have purchased all of the advertising time that disappeared. Mia Farrow is an actress who probably hasn't done a movie that I can think of in the last 15, 20 years, so that's okay, though. And Russell Simmons, he is an American businessman. He and another fellow started the hip-hop label Def Jam and also has a fashion clothing line out there called Fat Farm and American Classics. So if you agree with what they're doing, fine. If not, you know where you can put your money where your mouth is. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting that at least Hollywood is stepping up and supporting this show out there. So that's a good deal. Okay, Doctor, we're back. And when we left, I said I wanted to ask you about Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah.
Over the time when Occupy Wall Street was first starting to percolate and get started, it was almost like a wave through the news agencies. They were all saying this was the equivalency of the Arab Spring here in the United States, that the common man was standing up to the government and standing up to corporate big business and all these other things. Do you see the correlation? And if so, how? And if not, why not?
I don't see the correlation is that strong at all. It's like correlating a cancer cell, for example, and a normal cell, because both are cells. It's incomparable. What is the so-called Arab Spring is basically a reaction to extreme suppression of people and disrespect for them to a great extent by the leadership, either Mubarak system or the others, coupled with some form of desire and or religious desire to implement the Sharia rules, mixed with economical collapse that is far beyond what the Americans can imagine. Because here in America, even if you are weak, you can still there are many ways to still be able to really survive with some dignity. I know there is some people who are poor, no doubt, but still the level of poverty you cannot compare to some of these countries.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a mix of political suppression, extreme poverty, religious ideology working together. But what happened in Wall Street is just desire of some people who felt that the economy is not working well for them, and they thought that, in their view, that social justice can be implemented via demonstrating in front of Wall Street. It's very small in its scale. The roots of it are not that strong. That's why you don't see, for example, in Egypt, there was 18 million people in the last day demonstrating against Mubarak in the street.
Wow.
18 million out of what? Out of 80 million. So you are talking here about around more than 20% of the society. So this means in America here, 70 million people demonstrating. I don't think the number was even a fraction of this. So I can't see that. The spirit was there. I have seen some people in the Wall Street using the Arabic words that were used in Tahrir Square in Egypt. People who are, and both of them used Facebook and Twitter. There were some elements of similarity.
Right.
But these elements of similarity cannot say the two phenomena are similar.
Well, I thought it was fascinating when I would see these teenagers and 20-year-olds or so standing out there with an iPod and an iPhone complaining about capitalism.
Okay. It's very strange because they don't know that at the end these people in Wall Street, many of them also have the talent and the ability to use their money in a way to employ hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. So they didn't see the whole big picture and the scale was
smaller.
Yeah, so you can say there is some element of similarity, but the two phenomena are incomparable.
That's a very good point. Now, we have a caller, and I think I know who this caller is. Go ahead, caller. You're on the line.
Hello. Hello, doctor.
Hello.
My name is Rizky. I'm usually from Jerusalem. I'm in Florida right now.
Yeah.
And it was actually harder for me to get onto Skype than it is to get into Israel. I definitely understand what you're saying. There are some medium-aged Israelis who kind of have that same attitude. But I tend to think it's more because they weren't in the first generation and they're not now, they sort of don't know where they belong. And I think that that's a large part of the uneasiness. I find a lot less anti-Muslim feeling in Israel than I do the rest of the world. I find the world outside of Israel much more polarized. In Israel, everything is fairly clean cut.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe I'm reading things wrong, but, you know, I think the media overhypes the anti-Muslim sentiment in Israel and hypes the anti-Israeli sentiment within Israel. I'm talking about places. My daughter lives in a small town outside of Jerusalem, and right next to her is a Muslim village, and people come and go within the two villages interchangeably. They work one in one. The police, the guards on our Sabbath are Muslim. The guards on their Sabbath are Jewish. And I've never felt the sense that I do feel here. But then again, I also feel a lot more anti-Semitism now than I did before I left for Israel 5 years ago.
Do you have a question, Mom?
Yeah, I just would like to know how to go about fixing that. You know, you brought up so many good points, and, you know, where do we start, though? Where does the average person start try to bridge that gap?
Yeah. I think... So I understood the question, where does the average person stand, or how can he bridge that gap? I think the gap must be bridged by the Muslims first, not by the Westerners or the Israelis, because we knew, just see, some people say, oh, the West, some people in the Muslim world say the West discriminates against Islam, and I always say here, if you compare the number of mosques that were built in the West and even in Israel, in Europe, in the last few decades, and compare them to the number of synagogues and churches that were built in the Muslim world throughout the same period, then you will realize who is discriminating against the other. So I think we should not live in the fear, or the Westerners should not live in the feeling that, oh, they are the ones who have the responsibility to bridge the gap. I think what they can do is to open the gate, so that if someone bridges this gap, they should welcome him. This is number one. Number two, there are ways to go forward to push for the so-called moderate Muslims to start bridging this gap. Like, I'll tell you, one of the main problems that we face today is the lack of definition for radical Islam. People talk about moderate and radical without defining them. And I put a simple definition. It's available in my website, tawfiqhamid.com. You can read it. But it's a simple alphabet test that any group or organization who believe in the following concept concepts should not be considered moderates. The concepts are A, for apostate killing, B, for barbaric treatment of women like beating women and stoning, C, calling Jews pigs and monkeys. And I will stop at this one to give you an example. It goes to letter G, but I will just use this as an example how the ordinary Westerner person can play a role here. When people talk about moderate Islam, I was speaking one day in Dearborn, Michigan, and some imam interrupted me and said to me, why, Dr. Hamid, you mentioned these ABCs and these radical teachings. I said to him, I am a moderate imam. This is what he said, and I have Jewish friends, and I contribute to interfaith dialogue. I said to him, look, imam, if you don't mind, would you mind to prove to us that you are moderate instead of just telling this to us? And he said, or everyone was silent. I said to him, would you mind, imam, to go to invite us and some of our Jewish friends and brothers and sisters who are sitting with us tonight to your mosque next Friday prayer and stand in front of your congregation and say it clearly, loudly, and unambiguously that Jews are not pigs and monkeys. Would you mind to do this, imam? And he didn't say a word, he didn't utter a letter, and he couldn't do it. So what I'm saying here is, At some stage, you need to push for the bridging the gap by telling people, if you want us to consider you moderates, please stand against these values. Apostate killing, beating women, stoning women to death, calling Jews pigs and monkeys, declaring wars on non-Muslims to spread the religion, and all the letters available on my website. So what I'm saying here is sometimes you need an element of confrontation, but in a decent way, to tell people, if you are truly moderates and you want us to really have no gap or to bridge the gap, then you have to prove this to us. So any mosque, any Islamic organization, instead of just telling the world I'm a moderate, let them stand clearly against these principles. So this is how I see how can we bridge this gap? By number one, accepting those who already bridged it from the other side. Number two, pushing for it by insisting that I cannot consider you a moderate until I see clearly on your website, on media outlets, clear rejections for the violent ethics of Sharia.
Wow.
How's that?
Wow. I'm duly impressed. I just say salam alaikum to you. Thank you very much, Doctor. And I wish you, believe me with my heart and soul, all the success in the world.
Thank
for
you.
For both of our sakes.
Thank you
and
so much.
And both of our grandchildren's sakes.
So, it means a lot.
Be well.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks,
bye.
Mama. Have a good night. You bring up some very, very good points, Doctor. You know, we can speak, and this goes both directions. We can speak all we want about pacifism and being open with each other, but until we put it into action and we put it into words, it really is just a lot of hot air.
Yeah.
So, and I'm looking at your website now for the ABCs test, and it is a very impressive document that you've laid out here. Very simple, but I'm just curious, how many... people of the Islamic faith are coming to your website and then going on and agreeing with these statements? Are you getting a lot of positive response?
It's increasing. I can say years ago, you can say that there was rejection of my message because it was very confrontational to them, and they didn't want to really feel that there is something wrong. But nowadays, I see the complete change happening. I wrote recently on some article in Arabic, actually, and I was criticizing some radical things, and the article circulated all over the world and came back to me. So, through my friends who received it, and they never knew, I never sent it to these friends. So I see that the Muslim societies under the criticism, and when they saw the impact of radical Islam and impact of terrorism, when they started to feel threatened also with the radicals in their countries, like in Egypt, the liberals are so scared now from the radicals who are taking the parliament now and may end the country into Taliban-like style. So I see there is evolving change or change that's evolving in the Muslim societies, and more people are starting to listen carefully and accept my message. And especially my message is not just to reject these things, by the way. The real message, when you see all what I'm doing, I'm providing also an alternative interpretations for the Islamic text to provide a form of Islam that it does not have these radical teachings. It's not an easy job, but I include a lot of linguistics and a lot of relations between verses, trying to think at the concept level. So I have special interpretations. If you went to my website on the right, on your right hand, you'll have islamforpeace.org.
Yes.
If you clicked it, you will see how different ways of interpretations in the Islamic text can really bring a different outcome at the end, at the level of human behavior.
And ladies and gentlemen, please visit this site. If you don't get anything out of what we're talking about tonight, visit the website. I'm going to spell it out for you because most Americans are not very good at foreign language, and so we can't hear the nuance very well. So it's www.tawfik.com. HAMID.com. And I'm looking at the test for radical Islam. I see a place where we can get your book, Inside Jihad. Is that yours?
Yeah.
Okay. Islam for Peace, another connection. So it's just an excellent resource for us.
And you have a cartoon called Mr. Tolerance. It's funny cartoon, but it's in the field. You'd be surprised when you see it. It's called Mr. Tolerance, and it's a discussion between Bin Laden and some extremely tolerant guy, and it just shows that you cannot really have tolerance to cancer. Simply, you have to stand against it.
That's a good point. Listen, we've got about 12 minutes, and there's three questions. I always put out the word that I'm going to hold an event, and I ask people to email me questions. And there's three questions that have come back to me over and over, and I want to ask your opinion very quickly. And if you don't want to touch on these, that's fine. I'm perfectly okay with that, but I'll do the easy one first, or at least the easy one to get the answer from. With your situation and your website and all of the talking that you're doing, are you in danger? Do you feel like you've put yourself in harm's way?
I'm in danger, but I lived in this for more than 30 years, and I faced death in certain situations. So I'm really don't think much about it because it's out of my mind for one reason. I know that I will die one day or another, okay? I'm a human being. I will die. And there are two ways to die. Either to die as a coward who refused to stand against evil, or as a brave human being who stood against evil. And I chose the latter, as simple as that.
Wow. Very simply put, but very powerful message. Okay, now these next questions are a little more difficult, and when I first got them, I'm thinking, I don't know, but I'll go ahead and ask them because, you know, people have a right to ask them, and we shouldn't be embarrassed by their questions. When our president travels the world and what was often called the bowing and apologizing tour,
yeah.
Did that make America more receptive to the Islamic community, or did it show us as a sign of weakness in the Islamic community?
Sign of weakness, and the outcome at the end was negative in my view. I wrote an op-ed that the title be that the U.S. Must keep a critical balance between showing respect to the Muslim world and not being perceived as weak. That is the critical balance. If you went to with the king of Saudi Arabia, you give him a hug, but you don't bow to him. If you give him a hug, man to man, they respect you, they look up to you, because you are America. But if you started to bow, then you are disrespected, and then you will have difficulty actually to win their hearts and minds, because they like the powerful. They like they like power. That is
yes.
The psychology of the Muslim world. So trying to being perceived as weak actually hamper your interests there. So what I'm suggesting you go. You respect the place. You don't go with a bikini in a mosque, but you
right.
don't have really to go and put the hijab when you meet some of the leaders there, for example.
Okay.
So I think the critical balance here must be maintained between showing respect but without being perceived as weak. That is crucial. If the U.S. leaders did not care about this particular issue, then ultimately they will lose hearts and minds, not win hearts and minds.
Okay, and that leads me into the second one of the second questions, and this is something that I've had on my mind for a long time, and I'm very, very glad to be able to ask you this. When we as America send a female like Madeleine Albright
yeah.
or Hillary Clinton to these countries,
yeah.
how are they? I know they're receptive and they shake hands and they smile, but when all is said and done, positive effect or negative effect?
When what, sorry?
When we send like a female Secretary of State to
yeah.
Saudi Arabia or to other countries of Islamic faith, especially those that tend to be more radical.
Yeah.
How is that? Does that help us?
Yeah. Look, if this representative, whoever she is, wore the hijab, they will feel that America is bound to them. The American culture is inferior to Sharia-based culture. Islam is superior. You will start to stimulate in their mind the fear of grandiosity and superiority, and then you are actually losing here. But if she went there and she spoke with respect and she didn't put the hijab and she respected her own culture, then I do believe it's fine. It's absolutely fine.
Okay. Good point. Good point. All right. And here's the last question. And we after this, I want to talk about your book and how people can get your book. And this is the one when I read it, I got a bunch of these and I just kind of shook my head. The question is our president, our current president, if not a Muslim, is he a Muslim sympathizer?
I can see why you left this question till the end.
Like I said, if you don't feel like tackling,
I'm happy to answer. Look, I can't see that he is a Muslim. The guy is very, like, when you see him, it would be very primitive to think that he is a Muslim. This does not really work in my mind. But what I can say is that being brought up in a Muslim culture like Indonesia,
right,
in the early stage of your life, will certainly affect your mindset or psychology to some extent. It cannot be completely ignored in your life. And it was clear when President Obama said the best voice he has ever heard was the Adhan, which is a call for the prayer, the Muslim prayer. So we cannot say that the 9 years of his life, or probably more, in Indonesia did not have an impact. Especially his father was a Muslim, and he was brought up until 7 years old by a Muslim father, as far as I know. So you cannot just say this was completely separated from the human, his mind, because creation of your subconscious to some extent occurs at that level. What you love and what you hate, what you like, what you don't like, is created in this early stages of your upbringing.
Sure.
So it will be also unfair to say that this did not affect his way of thinking in a manner that make him have some form of sympathy toward the Muslim world. But it will be unfair to say that, or at least unfounded, to say that this is affecting his decisions in any way or another. I think having some form of sympathy is one thing, and letting or allowing this sympathy to affect your decisions is another thing. But I can say there should be some level of sympathy because of this upbringing, but it will be unfounded in my view, or maybe it's not my area of speciality to judge if this has or has not affected the decisions regarding the Muslim world and other parts of the world.
You tackled that very well.
And the question was very clever too.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you were you're willing to tackle that, because I know a lot of people who just would give a very short and, you know, a flippant answer, and that was definitely not your case there. Well, Doctor, thank you very much. Let's go ahead and ask you, how can we get a hold of your book? And we got your website here, but are you also on other places like Amazon?
Yeah. If you went even to the website, TawfiqHamid.com, and you click the book itself, it will take you to Amazon.com.
Okay.
So they can get it directly from Amazon.
Okay, yeah, I see.
Through this link. Or they write Inside Jihad, Tawfiq Hamid, or Inside Jihad Hamid, and it will come up Amazon immediately. So either through the website, it will take them to Amazon, or another way.
And you've got 5-star rating on Amazon, so you got a lot of people like the book. Good job. Well, you've definitely got a 5-star rating here as well. We certainly appreciate all the time you've given us. I know you're a very busy man. You're very busy today, and I'm sure you're tired. So an hour and a half of your time is something that we greatly respect. Thank you very much.
I enjoyed it too. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Well, you're honestly one of the best guests that we've had who's willing to talk on this issue, and it's just refreshing to hear what you had to say. And I'm going to encourage all of our listeners to please copy this file. send it to your friends, because this is a message that needs to get out far and wide.
Thank you, and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, sir. You too, bye as well, bye. And have a good night.
And you too. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you can't beat what we've you could have paid great money to go to an audience like this and participate in an event like this and listen to this gentleman, and you would have got your money's worth. So you especially got your money's worth tonight, because we charge so much for you to tune in and listen to the show. Thank you very much for coming. It's been a pleasure, and I'm certainly looking forward to some of the things that are coming up here in the near future. I'm in the process of aligning some people for the show that you don't want to miss. I know a lot of you have been hearing about this movie called Agenda, and the movie Agenda is absolutely one that you want to see. You can find it on the internet, but you want to stay tuned to our site, because I've got the gentleman who did the movie. He's going to come on the show, and so that's a big feather in the cap. He's going to be on, I believe, in February. So we're working out the details and getting the dates on that, but you just want to stick around. We've got more things cooking in the background than I know what to deal with, and I need somebody go out there and find me a very senile, filthy rich person who has no children, who wants to adopt a middle-aged guy doing a radio show, okay? I need you to go out there and do that, because I can certainly put that money to good use right here on the show. Thank you much again for listening. It's been a pleasure. And if you get the opportunity, go to redstatetalkradio.com. Peel down the right side of the page, and you'll see where they're voting for the Red State Talk Radio Host of the Year. Right now, I think I'm ahead by about, maybe 8 votes the last time I checked. And the second runner-up is a 13-year-old named Caden, who is giving me all sorts of grief on Facebook, and I hope he hears the show tonight. We want to blow him out of the water. And so tune in with us. Stay with us. Visit the site, vote. We just appreciate everything you're doing. God bless you all. I just love it. So have a good evening. Take care, and God bless.
Listen again every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern for Paul Revere Radio.